Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Tom Barbesh's new novel, The Dakota Winners, takes readers inside New York City's famed Dakota apartments through the eyes of a young man returning home. The novel creates a portrait of New York in 1980 and the people who made it unique, including the Dakota's most famous resident, John Lennon, and follows a family saga of a son negotiating his relationship with his father. He joins us now in studio to discuss his new novel. Welcome, Tom.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Glad to have you, and interested really in talking about this novel and bringing it to listeners' attention because, well, first of all, let me say it's an ambitious novel. It's a novel about New York during a particular era, specifically around 1980, but it's got a lot more in it, and I wanted to talk about what's at the heart of it, because if you go through the novel, you enter a world of sailing and you enter a world of tennis and movies and even malaria. There's a good deal here. But the fact of the matter is you're trying to capture a certain era, it seemed to me, and a milieu, too, as well.
Yeah, I think at the core of it, it's about a son who worships his father. Anton Winter is the son of Buddy Winter, who is a famed talk show host along the lines of Dick Cavett, a little bit of Johnny Carson. And I think...
And Jack Parr.
Yeah, and Jack Parr, exactly. And they have one central thing that's similar, which is that both men walked off their shows, famously. And that happened 2 years before the start of the book. But in terms of writing about the era, I think, as you know, as a talk show host, it is your job to be sort of on top of things culturally, politically, artistically. And so it was a good way to get at that era through this family that the son grew up on his father's talk show and is now trying to help his father get a new one and get his feet back.
Yeah, I didn't certainly mean to give short shrift to the family saga here. In fact, it's been compared to the Glass family of Salingers, I think, probably wisely in many ways, but it's also, as you say, a father-son novel and about that relationship and about a son helping a father in ways that are certainly revealing about him. And the son's name is Anton, and he is very dedicated and loves his father, but he's also struggling toward his own identity.
Yeah, I think what happens is that he, for so long, he's been so absorbed in his father's work. The other thing is that I was reading about how Cavett used to write, and he said that if he had the same joke and he wrote it for Bob Hope or Groucho or Carson, there'd be a different cadence, and it was very different. And so what Anton has learned how to do is to write for Buddy, not only that, to sort of think through, to look through things and know the sort of things that are going to catch Buddy's eye. And at one point, Buddy says to him, "You're like the other side of my brain," and he means it in a warm way, and at some point, that becomes an uncomfortable place for Anton to be.
I want to talk to you more about Anton and Buddy, but let's also talk about another element of this novel that's important, and that is the Dakota. I mean, it's a kind of haunted place, even associated with Rosemary's Baby, because it was supposed to be there, but also particularly with John Lennon, and it's a place that has a kind of upstairs-downstairs feel to it as well.
Exactly. Well, for me, I grew up on 77th Street, five blocks away from the Dakota, and it was sort of this big, looming, haunted castle on 72nd Street. And we knew about the famous people who lived there. But I have a friend, the writer Nina Solomon, and she grew up there. And I asked her, I said, it always seemed very haunted and gloomy to us. She said it did to us, too, at one point, which sort of surprised me. But it has this magnificent history. It originally had a staff of 250, a grand restaurant inside. They had a croquet lawn. They had a tennis court. And the idea was to create this kind of the sort of life you'd have if you lived in a great hotel, that you could permanently have that sort of existence in New York back in the late 1800s.
And a feeling of community. I mean, this is what allows Anton to become friends with John Lennon, no less, really.
Yes. And there's a ton of celebrities, you know, who've lived there. And the unwritten rule is that you just treat them, you don't treat them like stars. They're treated like neighbors. They're treated like your friends. And they don't have additional status. And I think for a lot of these people, a lot of what I discovered in the book is how badly people needed that feeling. They needed to sort of feel like they were in a small village and they were left alone when they wanted, but they had community as well.
Talking to Tom Barbesh, writer of a new book, a novel called The Dakota Winters, and his other books include the novel The Last Good Chance and the nonfiction book On Top of the World, Cantor Fitzgerald, Howard Lutnick, and 9/11, A Story of Loss and Renewal. Let's talk a bit about, because I noticed I really liked immensely, I've said this on the air, I believe, your last collection of short fiction. I like this novel too, but I have to be honest, not as much as I like your short fiction. Have you been getting that response?
No, you know, I think that in some ways, I got to come back to this neighborhood with their, and that's one thing. And then the other thing that I figured out about myself is that I'm very interested in that moment, I think, where the kids of parents suddenly see their vulnerabilities. And there's a lot of that in Stay Up With Me, that sort of sense of a kid growing up in some way and a parent needing them in a way which is alarming in some sense to a child. And so there are two of the stories, at least two or three of the stories in the collection had a similar theme.
I think you might have hit on something significant to me as a reader, and this is me as a reader, but you feel more of a sense of intimacy in those short stories in some ways, because the senses of Anton describing and cataloging for us his father. So you see things through Anton's eyes. You don't necessarily see Buddy casting a shadow here in a wide way.
There are two different forms, and I mean, I agree with you in terms of, I mean, I love short stories for that, just the power, the short power. And then I think with a novel, with this one, there's a sort of, my hope is, because I had it writing, is there's a kind of vicarious feeling that the reader has, that they get to go along on this great sea voyage with John Lennon. They get to go to these parties. They get to live in the year, you know, and recreating the year, that sort of experience that someone might have, and be around these people and then see them in a new light.
He did do a trip, that is, Lennon did, to Bermuda, and he did kind of save himself with macrobiotic diet.
With his own will. It's an astonishing story, and it's, when I landed on it, I just thought, I can't believe no one's written about it, which is, I think that John Lennon was really interested in going to sea in that last year. He learned how to sail. He bought a sailboat, and then he chartered a boat to go through the Bermuda Triangle to Bermuda. And along the way, there was a storm. There wasn't supposed to be one by when they looked at the charts. And there were gale winds, high seas, and everyone else got sick. But John had a macrobiotic diet, didn't get sick. And finally, Captain Hank Halstead turned the boat over to him after 30 hours of sailing. And John spent 7 hours sailing the boat, singing filthy Liverpool shanties at the top of his lungs, and saved everyone's life. And
saved his own career in many ways, didn't he? I mean, he had another turbulent, after that whole episode, he had another outgrowth of creativity.
Right? Exactly, which was directly tied to that feeling of being immortal. And he'd had a drought for 5 years, and then he wrote all of Double Fantasy in about 10 days.
It is an amazing story. And there's even a feel in this, it's no accident you used Melville before we even began the novel.
Yes. Well, I was reading all these great sea stories, and the Melville quote is about the luck, you know, of that we don't choose the day we live or die, and that the happenstance, what happened to John did not seem to me at all inevitable. I felt like he was in the beginning of a really vibrant second act, and which made it all the more tragic to think about what happened.
Again, we're talking to Tom Barbash. His new novel is called The Dakota Winners. And let's talk some more and explore this father-son relationship, because it's as if Anton wants to not only get his father back after the walk-off and get him to the kind of illustrious career he had before that and was trying to reshape for himself, but because of the connection to John Lennon, he wants to bring the Beatles back live on television.
Yes. Yeah.
What an aspiration. Huh?
Yes. Well, that it suddenly occurs to him that that's a possibility. And I actually think I may be alone in this, but that it would have happened. That I feel, even watching Let It Be, and the more that I read it, it is like watching a bunch of brothers or very close friends who've been fighting over things, and you have the feeling it's so annoying that they can't get over it, and that they will, that eventually. And I don't think they would have reformed the band, but the idea of them finishing that concert that was truncated, that last rooftop concert by the police, that the idea that they would pick right up and finish that concert made perfect sense to me.
Again, we're talking to Tom Barbash. By the way, if you'd like to join us, we're talking about much that's, it seems to me, implicit in the novel as well as explicit, and it has a lot to do with New York during a certain period, the grungy years or the grimy New York years, pre-Giuliani in some ways, or actually when Giuliani was coming in. Boy, what a different Giuliani we have today, huh? When he's coming in and making the streets a little more safe. But there's, you know, this sense of violence and urban dangers in this novel, and also a great deal to do, as we've been saying, about a father-son relationship and about all of that sort of Oedipus stuff that goes on in that relationship. We'd like to hear your thoughts and invite you to join this conversation. And you can come in here now at our toll-free number. Or if you're a fan of Tom Barabash's or you'd like to talk to him about his work, feel free to join the program. It's 866-733-6786 to be part of the program. Again, join us at 866-733-6786 or join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going into our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, and you can also, of course, go to our Facebook page. So why does Buddy walk off?
Well, I could ask you that because I think that...
It's a Rorschach for the reader?
Well, no. What I was saying as a talk show host, my sense of doing what you do, you know, and what Buddy does is you have to bring your best brain in. And that idea of and Buddy has, like Cavett and like Carson, he has that ability to sort of be electric, to be in the moment. And I think that he falls into a funk and he has less and less access to his best brain and he grows frustrated. And it seemed to make sense. It's sort of like all the circuits don't connect. And then he walks off. And the other aspect of it, too, is that I found a tremendous amount of celebrity breakdowns, people who wanted fame, achieved it, and then had to make this next step of figuring out why they do what they do and whether or not they want to continue it.
Well, he was a searcher, basically, wasn't he?
Very much so, as was John. You know, as was Elvis, you know, people who at some point begin to read widely and to try to figure out the universe and their place in it.
And Anton becomes the other side of his brain, but in some ways has to interpret his father's actions, not only for other people, but for himself.
Yeah. Well, I think it didn't make much sense to a lot of people around then. It didn't make sense to Anton. He goes off to the Peace Corps before the start of the novel, and as you mentioned, he comes back with a case of malaria. Otherwise, he is not there to help his father. And they both convalesce together and try to figure out their next steps.
Why did you I know, like I said, you were trying to write a historical novel in some ways, but bringing in Teddy Kennedy's run for the presidency?
Well, as I looked at 1980 and I found it to be an incredibly pivotal year. I mean, you have the hostage crisis, the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, but a really consequential presidential election. I grew up, my Upper West Side family was intensely political, and we had constant conversations about whoever for presidential elections, senatorial elections. And I imagine that the winters, along with being, you know, TV family, that politics would be big. And so, in fact, Emily Winter, Anton's mom, works, does some help for the Kennedys, who are friends of theirs. I also imagine that Buddy would be friends of the Kennedys.
There's also the Gene Harris, Herman Tarnover, Scarsdale murders. I mean, there are touches of guardian angels. I mean, a lot comes in to the novel that tries to, again, give us a feel for the era. But there's also a kind of what I call Day of the Locust feel here. I mean, Nathaniel West's famous apocalyptic novel. Feel that 1980 was a pivotal year in the sense that we were on verge of something. Not only the Iran hostage crisis, but on verge of a kind of chaos and violence that we had perhaps not anticipated before that, maybe more somnolent years.
Well, what happened is we had Watergate, and then we had the end of the Vietnam War, and then we elected a liberal, a Democrat, and we felt like this was the beginning of a new era, and that didn't seem to work out. And now we had this turbulent election and the hostage crisis, which turned everything upside down. New York, as you said, it had a really sinister feel. I read an article that reminded me of things that were happening. They said that there was a high amount of stranger killings, so really just pointless things, and people being pushed in front of subway trains at an alarming rate. And the city was so bankrupt, they couldn't get enough money together to get bulletproof vests for the police. So there was all this stuff coming together and you couldn't see the future at that point. You couldn't see that the city was going to be flush with cash soon. At that point, it did feel like you were at the end of something.
There was. I was going to ask you if you wanted to read something, but before I do, I want to touch on what we just spoke about for a moment with a passage that was striking to me, and it was at the end of the 16th chapter. This is Anton's voice. Maybe you should read it, not me.
What page is it?
It's 142. It's right at the end of the 16th chapter. So it begins with him walking home and thinking of a heckler, because Buddy, his father, is not only a talk show host, but he's a stand-up comic, and he goes through a lot of the material and jokes that well, essentially, like you said, they're a team, but comes up with stuff on his own. So we're right in that last paragraph.
Yeah, and this follows Buddy is furious at a heckler who went after Joan Kennedy in a talk she gives at the Park Tavern.
Joan Kennedy being Teddy Kennedy's wife, yeah.
Yes. I walked home thinking of that heckler, of Buddy treating him like a blowhard at a neighborhood association meeting when he could easily have been a lunatic with a Glock strapped to his leg. And I thought of Alex, that's his friend, getting jumped, and the subway riders pushed in front of trains, two more in the last week. What made you want to end the life of a stranger? And did you plan your crime, or did the desire seize you out of nowhere, like the impulse to key the side of a car? A week ago, my brother Kip had climbed two flights of subway stairs on his way home from practice, and when he reached the top, a gold-toothed behemoth of a man grabbed his tennis rackets and threw them down the full stairs because he felt like it. He even smiled, and he said, "What?" as though Kip hadn't the right to object. Something mean was building out there.
Yeah. it's become normative, maybe. Here was the beginning of this opening up, and now there's meanness all over, ubiquitous.
Well, I have to say that what happened to Kip did happen to me. I was a tennis player. I climbed to the top of the subway stairs. This enormous man grabbed my rackets and threw it down two flights of stairs and just looked at me, and there was nothing I could do. But there were things like that would happen, and I got mugged pretty regularly. I had money not set aside, not for if I got mugged, for when I got mugged. I'd have about $10-$15 for that.
But there's something just like a tennis racket that can incite and be a catalyst to violence. You know, you see a tennis racket, and if you think of somebody as being spoiled because they can play tennis or something like that, it can incite.
Undoubtedly, yeah.
I mean, we try to look for rationality behind some of that violence, but I'm not sure it's there. Let's go to some of our callers, and you can join us with Tom Barabash. His new book is called The Dakota Winners, and our toll-free number again is 866-733-6786. Here's Wanda from Oakland who wants to talk about Lennon. Hi, Wanda.
Hi. Well, on a lighter note, as the author has written a book about him, I wondered if he had any comment on John Lennon's own books. He was very proud of his poetry. In His Own Right, W-R-I-T-E, and A Spaniard in the Works. I can't think of the third one. I've lost my original copies, but most people aren't even aware he did that. And I think he was very proud of them. And people should know about them. And if he has any comments, I'd appreciate it.
Tom?
Yeah, Wanda, they're terrific books. And also his letters are wonderful. And I have a copy of his collected letters. I don't know who the publishers are, but you can get those. Incredible sense of humor, really playful with language. I think he was just very, very funny. And that was one of the things I tried to capture in the book, was his intelligence and wit.
You also try to capture the relationship with McCartney, which is still under a lot of microscopic examination, trying to figure out what was really behind it and where was the difficulties and so forth.
Yeah, and examine those resentments. And I tried to see things from all of their point of view. In fact, I spoke to a friend who's a marriage counselor, and I asked her to sort of talk about John and Paul as a married couple and their dynamic, and she gave me incredible insights, you know, to that. And that's how I sort of thought it, of how can these people who are that close work it out.
Are we at an anniversary of Lennon's death, I think?
Yeah, it was Saturday.
It was just this past Saturday, right. That's right. I remember I was on the air, and it was quite a shock, to put it mildly. But there was even a great shock, and I think he's still living it down, when you heard Paul McCartney respond by, he was asked, "What do you, you know, John Lennon died?" He said, "Yeah, it's a drag, isn't it?" And whoa, I just try to assimilate that. You know, I mean, it was such a shocking response. And to this day, he's tried to explain it in different ways and so forth. But having witnessed it, it was quite difficult. Here's Julie who says, "Please tell Tom," this is the sort of thing teachers love to hear, "that some of us from his 2003 creative nonfiction class at Stanford are still in touch with each other. We still write, some of us more than others, and we still talk about what we learned and pieces that we were introduced to by Tom."
Oh, that makes me feel great. As you said, that's wonderful.
And here's another caller. From Santa Rosa, we welcome Oshara. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Awesome. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. I listen to your guys' station all the time, and I just really love what you're saying today. I think it's really awesome to hear that there was, you know, more kind of like just hearing about stuff in the 1800s from like New York, that's the thing I sort of heard first. And I just really like that you guys are sort of expressing these feelings around, you know, mean people and circumstances that happen. I feel like the more we talk about it, the more we can find solutions and just be aware and maybe have better things to say to those people when, you know, when they're offending, you know?
I think I get the thought. Yeah. Thank you for that, Tom.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the comment about the 1800s, it's funny to imagine that writing in 1980 now is writing historical fiction. I always thought to write historical fiction, you would be writing about the late 1800s. And I did have, in anything you write about the Dakota, you need to have that sort of sense of history to it because so many fascinating people have lived there over the years. But creating 1980 was an act of historical research as well at this point.
There's also coming to grips with the Upper West Side. You talked about the Dakota being a community and like a place unto itself. So was the Upper West Side.
Very much so. So there was a disproportionate...
So is the Upper West Side.
Yeah. Well, after deinstitutionalization of the mental institutions, a lot of the people that were let out on the Upper West Side, a disproportionate... And there was the highest rate, I think, of drug addicts almost anywhere in the country also on the Upper West Side. And there was incredible revival movie theaters and great bookstores and artists that lived there. But my block, 77th, which is now a very expensive block, on our block was a welfare hotel in which a man killed seven women for their appliances. And that was on my block. So it was fascinating. It was dicey. It had great things and really troubling things in my childhood.
And as a novelist, you're trying to capture not only what you saw in that childhood, but you're also, I mean, it's not only your memories that are working here, but it's also all of your senses. You're trying to capture the whole feeling of growing up in that part of New York and then going into other parts of New York and actually experiencing them the way that Anton experiences them.
Very much so. And so my mother passed away when I was in college and my dad died around 20 years ago. And the experience of writing the book, they're not in there as characters, but I felt like I was seeing so many things through their experiences. And I felt like I was spending time with them, which was another really intense part of writing this book.
And again, if you want to join us with Tom Barbash, you can do so by toll-free number 866-733-6786. If you have something you'd like to add to this conversation or if you want to email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post any questions or thoughts you might have there at kqed.org/forum and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. There's a lot in this novel about the Winter Olympics. What was it about the Winter Olympics that drew you? Is that also your childhood?
Well, I imagined, first of all, it's the joke Buddy makes is, of course, they're going to go to the Winter Olympics. But it's also in New York at a time, and it's a chance early on for Buddy to get back in the game. There's going to be a lot of network TV folks. There's a lot of people that are going to be there. So the idea of getting Buddy sort of out of his routines of just sort of going to the gym and back home or swimming or getting him out and around people. And then it was a very important Olympics because all the political backdrop to those Olympics ended up being important to all the other things that were happening in that year.
So tell us about the novelists that have had the most impact on you through your life or even in specifically writing this novel.
Well, Dr. O, reading Ragtime was, of course, and I love the story that I read, is that supposedly, and I tell my students this about being blocked, supposedly he was lying on the floor of his apartment looking at the wall and not knowing what he was going to write about. And then he wondered how old was this wall, and so he figured out how old the building was. And then he imagined what New York was like in that era. And then all of a sudden he started to write his book. But his ability to weave in famous people, important events, and make it come to alive in such a vivid way was important to me. You mentioned Salinger is important to me, and in this book a lot, in some ways, is The Great Gatsby, was an
important book.
It has
that feeling,
for me,
yeah.
As well.
And you mentioned Doctorow. I'm just wondering, in writing a novel, do you feel, Doctorow explained it on a few occasions, in fact, an interview I did with him many years ago, that it's like going into a dark tunnel and not necessarily knowing where you're going, and then suddenly you see the lights, and the lights converge.
Yeah, that's
a perfect metaphor.
Yeah, and a lot of times you have these different storylines. I mean, I had several different storylines and trying to figure out where they converge. And what happens is they do in an exciting way, and then you lose one or two because they don't. So you get to that point, and then you sort of see that. And then something that you thought was going to be a pivotal part of the book, I was joking about this with a friend yesterday, never saw the light of day.
Did you want to have us learn more about the brother and sister of Anton? I wondered about that because I got pretty interested in the sister, I mean, just as a reader, and the younger brother, who was also a character who I felt I wanted to know more about.
Yeah, well, that's I hope that people will read it and want to know more about it. Yeah, and there are those possibilities. You can imagine doing much more with the mother as well. And Rachel,
who was a famous actress,
right?
Fact, yeah,
right. I see it's charade. So I imagined her being in a cult film, and having the uncomfortable feeling Anton would go to. I had a whole scene that I didn't put in the book of Anton going to a revival theater and sitting with his mother and watching a romantic scene and feeling uncomfortable sitting next to his mother as he watched it.
But you get the feeling in your novel, though, about the importance of fame and how much it affects the way people are presenting themselves or the way they're perceived and so forth. And yet you also get that because it takes place in 1980 and because a lot of these names are almost the stuff of trivia now, like I mentioned, the Tarnower murder and so forth, the ephemerality of fame. I mean, especially for those of us who do this kind of thing, like sit behind a microphone, you know, it's going to be it's very evanescent. And I realize it from time to time. And sometimes it really hits me hard and sometimes it just hits me softly.
Yeah, I think that's true, and that's the point that Rachel at times tries to make to Anton, is that Buddy was famous for about 10 years before he's had this hiatus, and the idea was that's pretty good. You know, if you given how ephemeral they are, fame is, that idea of 10 years in the spotlight is pretty good.
So it's quite a run, in fact, in that spotlight world. Stephen, join us. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I've just been ended up for the author. I also grew up in New York City on the Upper West Side. I also lived on 77th Street. I forgot he said he lived on 77th Street in the 100 block.
Yeah, no, I lived in 40 West 77th, Stephen.
Okay, close. I also lived on West 77th near Broadway. I can't remember the address. I also was greatly affected by John Lennon's death living there at the time. I actually had a friend who lived in the Dakota. And it was such a scene to, like, get to see him. They had printed all these special IDs. You could only go in with such permission. He actually lived in the apartment building right above, or apartment right above, and we used to see them in the elevator all the time. So,
Stephen, thank you for that memory. Good to hear from you. My memory is quickened with the thought that, as I said, I was on the air, and I heard, actually, before I went on the air, I was talking with somebody who was trying to book the Grateful Dead, and it was their former manager, and all of a sudden he screamed Lennon had been shot and killed. A lot in this book. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Congratulations on the Dakota winners. It's Tom Barbash's new novel, and we'll be with you on tomorrow if all goes according to plan. Michael Chabon says about this new novel, deft, funny, touching, and sharply observed, a marvel of tone and a skillful evocation of a dark passage in the history of New York City. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Thank you for being with us for this morning's forum, and if all goes according to plan, we'll be back on tomorrow, as I said. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.